Good evening, everyone. I'd like to begin by thanking my hosts for affording me such a pleasant stay here at the center. Special thanks to Professor Lackner and Petra for all of her work behind the scenes, but a really sincere thanks to everyone here at the center. It's been a very, very enjoyable stay. My IKAGEF project features translations of the following five collections of biographical accounts of late 4th to early 7th century doctors, diviners, and artisans from five standard histories, five Chinese standard histories, completed between the mid-6th and the mid-7th century. Please note that the table you see on the slide is table number 1 in the handout. The first text that I'll be talking about this evening is the Shui Liezhuang, or Arrayed Traditions of Adepts of Techniques and Arts of the Wei Shu, or Book of Wei, which was completed in 554 during the Northern Qi Dynasty and covers the period between 386 and 534. The second text is the Fangji Liezhuang, or Arrayed Traditions of Adepts of Formulas and Skills in the Bei Qi Shu, or Book of Northern Qi. The third text is the Yishu Liezhuang, or Arrayed Traditions of Adepts of Arts and Techniques in the Book of Zhou. The fourth is the Arrayed Traditions of Adepts of Arts and Techniques in the Sui Shu. And the final collection is the Arrayed Traditions of Adepts of Arts and Techniques in the History of the Northern Dynasties. All five collections contain valuable information about mantic and medical lineages and communities. The geographic distribution, transmission, and transformation of mantic and medical practices, and the manner and context in which divination and healing were likely performed in late 4th to early 7th century North China, particularly in the mid to lower Yellow River region. A strong tension between state ritual concerns and the intractable popularity of divination and healing is clearly apparent in these works. This tension not only forces the compilers to be explicit about the insider orthodox perspectives they promote, but it also forces them to introduce much about the outsider heterodox perspectives they mean to combat. As such, I treat each of these collections as imperfectly biased filtration devices for mid-medieval Chinese mantic and medical culture. I contend that there is no better collection of texts for illustrating the significant contributions of doctors, diviners, and artisans to 5th and 6th century Chinese politics, science, and religion. No better collection of texts for highlighting the liminal spaces occupied by contemporary doctors and diviners between common and elite, official and non-official, and religion and science, and few better sources for examining the places of fate, freedom, and prognostication in mid-medieval Chinese mantic and medical culture. There are, however, a number of forces working against easy defenses of these claims. First, the standard histories of China were predominantly compiled for the imperial state. They're colored sources, or sources that promote a specific view of what makes a doctor, diviner, or artisan, or a mantic technique, medical technique, or craft worthy of being commemorated, worthy of being let in. In other words, these collections immediately and explicitly reveal much more about representation than reality. Second, because the court-sponsored histories preserving these collections were compiled relatively close to the times, the chaotic times they describe, earlier source material is relatively limited. And third, much depends on how one approaches terms like diviner, doctor, and artisan, not to mention terms like technique, formula, skill, craft, fate, freedom, and prognostication. I'll address problems of nomenclature a bit later in my talk, but let me begin with a few tempered but still heuristic definitions of some of the terms in my title. A diviner is a person skilled in culturally constructed means of encoding and decoding inherently ambiguous signs associated with culturally constructed notions of divine power. Diviners are especially skilled in the encoding of signs, in other words, the act of production or perception of signs or omens, while prognosticators are especially skilled in their decoding, in other words, the interpretation of signs, the pronouncement of oracles. Diviners routinely divine and prognosticate, prognosticators a bit less so. A doctor or physician is a person skilled in culturally constructed means of diagnosing, prognosing, treating, and preventing culturally constructed notions of bodily, spiritual disorder. And an artisan or craftsperson is a person skilled in an applied art, a person with a specialized skill, typically one acquired through practice, which tends to utilize traditional methods. The five collections I'm comparing all belong to the genre of biography. More specifically, they belong to the Chinese literary genre of Zhuan, a term that literally means transmission or tradition. Zhuan were attached to the Confucian classics in the late Warring States period as commentaries, but by the early Han Dynasty, the term came to be used for biographical accounts. The term Zhuan is often translated as biography or hagiography, but because of the generically varied characteristics of Han and medieval Zhuan, and the fact that the term continued to be used for commentaries, many sinologists call them traditions. I think tradition well captures both the formulaic framework of biographic Zhuan and their function as repositories for a wide range of different types of compositions, including poems, hymns, rhyme prose, memorials, edicts, letters, and technical discourse. Each of the traditions is treated as an artifact of persuasive communication, which, when analyzed and compared to others, begins to provide us with a clear picture of the social roles of mantic and medical specialists and the social processes through which images of diviners, healers, and artisans were constructed. My talk this evening addresses the following questions. How should the traditions comprising each of our collections be approached, and what is to be gained from a careful study of them? Where, when, and by whom were our collections and their individual traditions compiled? To what degree are the trinity of basic types of adepts, doctors, diviners, and artisans I'm using based on medieval Chinese terms and taxonomies? What do the traditions tell us about the social roles of doctors, diviners, and artisans in late 4th to early 7th century North China? And what do the traditions tell us about fate, freedom, and prognostication? Beginning with number one, I approach the biographical traditions collected in our five histories as narratives. There's a great deal of modern scholarship on what narratives are, how they should be studied, and why they are important. Sarah Isles Johnston, for example, points out that, quote, "We are narrating, we are all narrating, all the time. From the moment we wake up in the morning until the moment we fall asleep at night, we are creating and sharing narratives, whether or not we are conscious of doing so," unquote. And narratives, as many of you know, can be simultaneously true and false in different ways. Narratives are not simply structures that accurately relate information, they are information-sharing events that happen. Moreover, in the words of literary critic Barbara Herndstein Smith, quote, "No narrative version can be independent of a particular teller and occasion of telling, and therefore we may assume that every narrative version has been constructed in accord with some set of purposes and interests," unquote. Text and context can reveal much about these purposes and interests, and the more one understands the mediation of a narrative, the better one is able to hypothesize about what is being mediated or communicated. So, I approach traditions as sources of information on the times they describe, but I also approach them as narrative events, which reflect the times in which they were produced. I do not regard one or another of these dual approaches as superior to the other, but I afford primacy to the truth of narratives as events. As such, I want to contextualize the production and transmission of each collection before doing the same for the times they describe. I begin with the 24 standard histories as a whole. For the whole list, see number two, table number two in the handout. My study focuses on chapters or fascicles recorded in numbers 7, 10 to 12, and 15. A bit more than half of the 24 standard histories contain the kinds of traditions featured in my talk this evening, as Table 3 in the handout shows. Once again, my study focuses on numbers 7, 10 to 12, and 15. And just a few comments on these collections. Of course, the first example you see up there from the Shiji is not a collection per se. We're talking about different traditions that emphasize the kinds of techniques and arts that I'll be talking about this evening. Then we go on to the Sanguo Zhi, which is the first of the standard histories to actually compile these traditions together. And then on to the Houhan Shu, and then 7, 10, 11, and 12, the works that I'm dealing with. Number 13 I've left off the list for reasons that I can get into later from the Jin Shu. And then I'd just like to briefly mention 16 and 19. There has been some work done on both of these collections by some idiot about 20 years ago. And you're me, by the way. You're welcome to ask questions about those a bit later too, but I'm not covering them in my talk this evening. All right, so my use of the general term formulas and techniques, or fang shu, in the title of Table 3 is a purposeful choice. I regard it as the fundamental category running through the kinds of chapters listed in the table. I borrowed the term from the late 1st century CE Book of Han bibliographic treatise, where it's used as an abbreviation for the bibliographic categories fang ji, or formulaic skills, and shu shu, or calculation techniques. The term formulas and techniques is also used for the title of the Book of Latter Han chapter listed in Table 3, which I just showed you, but it drops out of use to make room for arts, or yi, and skills, or ji. Post-5th century standard histories add arts, or skills, to the established fang shu complex to create two new compound categories. Yi Shu, arts and techniques, and Fang Ji, formulas and skills. As far as I can tell, arts and skills were added as a matter of convenience. There was simply no better place to add accounts of skilled craftsmen like engineers, engravers, and script specialists. And while there are no significant differences between the kinds of practices and practitioners featured in Yi Shu and Fang Ji collections, the choice of terms might have been politically motivated. Mantic practices deemed more dangerous and in need of explicit imperial control during periods of division. Before we leave this slide behind, I'd like to take the opportunity to say something about how these materials have been studied in the past, particularly the similar collections that immediately precede our own, from the late 3rd century Chronicles of the Three Kingdoms and the mid-5th century Book of Latter Han. Both of these works are carefully translated and studied by French sinologist No Van Schitt in his 1976 Divination, Magie et Politique dans la Chine ancienne, and by American sinologist Kenneth J. DeWatskin in his 1983 Doctors, Diviners, and Magicians of Ancient China, Biographies of Fang Shi. A detailed analysis of these works is far beyond the scope of my talk, but I will say that No's work was well received, while DeWatskin's was not. Reviewers of DeWatskin's work, like Judith Boltz and Donald Harper, point to a lack of background, text-critical work, and references, especially a lack of references to No's earlier study. They also criticize the work for mistranslations, faulty explanations, and the absence of Chinese characters. Boltz and Harper further criticized DeWatskin for not addressing Taoist sources or archaeological discoveries, and Harper adds errors of fact stemming from a misunderstanding of specific techniques to his rather harsh review. I only mention these comments because they provide me with a good blueprint for what to do in my own work, which also tries to pay more attention to regional differences, lineages, and the discursive formation of each person commemorated. That said, let me address something about the who, when, and where of our collections. How are these collections compiled? Well, the easy answer to this question is in different ways, but let me explain. The Book of Wei was compiled by Wei Shou and his father, while the books of Northern Qi, Zhou, and Sui were completed by the second major Tang commission organized to compile the histories of the Northern and Southern dynasties. According to the former Book of Tang, in 621 CE, the historian Ling Hu Defeng informed Li Yuan, founder of the Tang dynasty, that time was running out for the chance to fill in the histories of early dynasties because people who had been alive during those periods would soon be gone. Li Yuan responded by commissioning histories for the Northern Wei, Northern Qi, Northern Zhou, and Sui in the north, and the Liang and Chun in the south. Three scholars were appointed for each dynasty, except for the Sui, which only had two. However, these scholars were unable to complete their projects, and in 629, 2 years into his reign as the second ruler of the Tang, Li Shimin established the second commission. This second general commission included the same histories comprising the first commission, minus the history of the Northern Wei, because there was already an acceptable version of that history. Our fifth collection, from the history of the Northern Dynasties, merely collects together, with very little change, the traditions found in corresponding sections of the first four collections. The first four collections predominantly relied on separate traditions, earlier versions of histories, and oral accounts for source material. Separate traditions, or biazhuan in literary Chinese, were typically written immediately following a person's death, but not always. They were often preserved in tomb epitaph inscriptions, or muzhiming, and while there are many extant examples of epitaph inscriptions from the Tang, this is not true for the periods I'm covering. I have yet to find a separate tradition or a tomb memorial inscription commemorating any of the figures featured in our five collections, but numerous clear examples of this appropriation can be found in other arrayed traditions in our histories. So who is to say that Wei Shou and the early Tang historians did not fabricate everything out of thin air? One way to answer this question is to cite from Li Yuan's edict ordering the initiation of the first Tang commission responsible for recompiling the histories of the Wei and Northern and Southern dynasties. Part of the edict reads, "Directors of the canon arrange discourse, while official historiographers record events. They both examine discussions and acquire what is missing, exhaustively scrutinizing changes and consistencies. In doing so, they delineate and create right principle types, reproving the wicked and promoting the good to increase knowledge about the past and to bequeath it as a mirror for the future. They should not only strive to precisely verify facts, but to broadly select from past anecdotes, be right principled and error-free, and write by the rules without concealing anything." Li Yuan's edict, as Victor Xiong eloquently puts it, underscores the didactic function of official historiography, balanced by another characteristic that values professional honesty. We'll get into the content of the traditions in a moment, but let me finish this brief contextualization of source material with a few comments on the transmission of the first four collections. One of the best indications that these works were actually read and circulated is that Li Shimin and his court continued to compile, discuss, and recompile them. I've already pointed out that the 659 CE history of the Northern Dynasties combines together our first four collections, but the mid-12th century bureaucratic compendium Tong Zhi, or Comprehensive Treatises, does the same, and earlier works, like the mid-10th century encyclopedic Taiping Yulan, or Taiping Period Encyclopedia for Imperial View, and the early 11th century bureaucratic and ritual compendium Cifu Yuangui, or the Primordial Turtle Storehouse of Manuscripts, draw extensively from all of our arrayed traditions. Moreover, all five histories are consistently recorded in major bibliographies, and many of the individual traditions are modified and incorporated into later collections of hagiographies and tales. I could say a bit more about transmission, but I'll save a bit of time and move on to problems with terms and taxonomies used to designate and categorize practices. The arts, yi, techniques, shu, formulas, fang, and skills, ji, featured in the titles of the five arrayed traditions I examining, are never listed together as a four-character phrase, but the blanket phrase, formulas, techniques, skills, and crafts, or fang shu ji qiao, is found in the conclusion to the Book of Ways, Arrayed Traditions of Adepts of Techniques and Arts, and in the introduction to the corresponding chapter in the history of the Northern Dynasties. The passage in the Book of Wei reads, Your humble scribe declares, as for poetry, history, rites, and music, little has been lost, so previous rulers emphasized the virtues in them. As for formulas, techniques, skills, and crafts, much has been lost, so the wise men of old treated these arts lightly. He who is never able to corrupt the customs when circulating the formulas and techniques, and is able to always tread within the rites when practicing skills and crafts, is on the verge of being a great and cultivated gentleman. The first two characters in bold print, formulas and techniques, or fang and shu, refer to the two compounds, formulaic skills, fang ji, and calculation techniques, shu shu, which essentially refer to mantic and medical practices. I read the second half of the phrase in bold print, ji qiao, as a single category equivalent to arts or crafts. These three categories of practice, mantic techniques, medical techniques, and arts or crafts, provide the basis for my initial division of practitioners into doctors, diviners, and artisans. A more detailed taxonomy of practices and practitioners, however, is described and defended in the introduction to the Book of Sui's Arrayed Traditions of Adepts of Arts and Techniques, which reads, Yin and Yang are used to standardize the seasons and days. They order the sequences of qi. Crack and yarrow, in other words, divination with turtle shell and yarrow stalks, are used to resolve doubts and suspicions. They settle indecision. Medicine and spirit mediumism are used to guard against enchantment and deviance. They nourish inner nature and life. Tone and pitch are used to harmonize human and spirit. They moderate the mournful and the celebratory. Physiognomy is used to differentiate noble from base. It illuminates the portions and the patterns. Skills and crafts are used to make tools and utensils beneficial. They help alleviate difficulties and hardships. This six-part taxonomy is then reiterated and reinforced with a list of names, four legendary or historical exemplars for each of the six categories. Too large to fit on a slide, see table 5 in the handout, six categories of arts and techniques and corresponding exemplars in Sui Shu 78. Categories number 1 to 4 in table 5 correspond to the mantic, category number 5 to the medical, and number 6 to crafts or arts. This division is displayed in the next table, table 6, which also illustrates how fang or formulas are distinguished from ji or skills. And I can say a little bit about this. I mean, it's very, very tempting here to treat formulas as something that is specifically confined to medicine and spirit mediumism. But again, I'm dealing with two compound categories that are encompassed by the simple term techniques, shu, and formulas, fang, right? Shu equals fang shu and shu shu, and formulas equals the same thing, shu shu and fang shu, leaving arts and skills as the kind of additional category that's lopped onto this. While problems with nomenclature remain, the trinity of practitioner types I am proposing is merely a refinement of early Chinese terms and taxonomies used in the collections. Much more could be said about the degree to which earlier, contemporary, and later institutional, bibliographic, and biographic taxonomies overlap or deviate from this particular organization. But I'd like to move on to the contents of our collections and what they tell us about the roles of doctors, diviners, and artisans in late 4th to early 7th century North China. I'll start with a bit of historical background. After the fall of the Han Dynasty in 220 CE, the Chinese Empire divided into three major kingdoms. In 265, the Western Jin Dynasty reunited much of China proper, but in 318 it collapsed, both within and from without. The subsequent depopulation of the north and mass migration south created a new empire centered in the south known as the Eastern Jin. While the Eastern Jin Dynasty maintained unity in the south, in 420 it also fell, giving way to a succession of southern dynasties until the Sui reunified north and south over a century and a half later in 589 CE. The traditions that comprise our collections, however, focus on the northern dynasties that developed after the fall of the Western Jin in 318 and after the splintering of the north into a series of short-lived states, most of which were founded by ethnic minority peoples who had settled in northern China during the preceding centuries and who had participated in the overthrow of the Western Jin. A few of these non-Han or barbarian peoples included the Xiongnu in the north, the Proto-Tibetan or Turkic Di people in the west, the Jie in the northwest, and the Tibetan-Burmese Qiang people in the southwest, but it was the Toba clan of the Turkic or Mongolian Xianbei peoples who established the Northern Wei in 386 and united most of North China by 439. The Toba clan headed a western branch of the Xianbei and occupied the northernmost reaches of the Mid-Yellow River region. In 315, the chief of the Toba was granted the title Prince of Dai by the Western Jin. Although the state of Dai survived the fall of the Western Jin, it was conquered by the former Qin state in 376, only to rise again after the former Qin and its leader, Fujian, was defeated by Eastern Jin forces at the famous Battle of Fei River in 383 CE. This was the closest that China had come to being reunified after the collapse of the Western Jin. Reunification of North and South would not be achieved until the Sui, almost two centuries later, in 589. While I don't have time to offer detailed histories of the Northern Wei, Northern Qi, Northern Zhou, and Sui dynasties, I can outline a few of the major transitional events that occurred during the late 4th to early 7th centuries, as I do in this slide. The question I'd like to ask here is to what extent the figures commemorated in our collections are said to have been involved in the major historical events of the late 4th to early 7th centuries. The answer is much, as the following examples show. 383, Battle of Fei River. Fujian of the former Qin attacks the Eastern Jin and loses. Zhang Yuan, in Book of Wei, tradition number 2, uses astrological knowledge to warn Fujian about his campaign against the Eastern Jin in 383, but Fujian ignores the warning and suffers a great defeat at the Fei River. In 398, Tuoba Gui declares himself Thearch of Northern Wei. Chao Chong, Book of Wei tradition number 1, advises Tuoba Gui against advancing troops in 397, late 397. Tuoba Gui rejects Chao's prognostication, voices his own, and is so successful that he declares himself Thearch in the following year. In 534, the Eastern Jin was established with support from Gao Huan. Four of the adepts of formulas and skills in the Book of Northern Qi were lodged guests, or guan ke, of Gao Huan, meaning that they were employed and afforded lodging by his household. Three of these men later won official positions in the Northern Qi court. Wang Chun, in Book of Northern Qi tradition number 2, is said to have helped Gao Huan defeat rebels in 532 by prognosticating an auspicious time of attack. In 535, the Western Wei is established with support from Yuan Tai. The introduction to Zhoushu 47, the collection in the Zhoushu, the Book of Zhou, clearly states that Yuan Tai sought the help of adepts of arts and techniques to help him establish the Northern Zhou. Examples are found in the Book of Zhou traditions of Ji Jun, Jiang Sheng, and Li Jingxi. Ji Jun uses his expertise in script to forge a decree from the Thearch summoning reinforcements for Yuan Tai. Jiang Sheng efficaciously interprets astrological omens that help Yuan Tai plan military campaigns. And Book of Sui tradition number one claims that Yu Jicai regularly observed the stars with Yuan Tai and often prognosticated the success of military campaigns for him. In 550, the Northern Qi is established by Gaoyang. In Book of Northern Qi tradition number four, Song Jingye relates an oracle from the Yiji Lantu, or charts for scrutinizing and perusing the changes, suggesting that Gaoyang would later receive the mandate of heaven, that is. Gaoyang immediately attempts to do so, but he fails. Song Jingye then performs a Yarrowstock reading and declares that the time is finally right. Gaoyang tries again and succeeds in establishing the Northern Qi. And Jiang Yuanyo, in the Book of Northern Qi tradition number one, manufactures a 9 refinements golden elixir to extend the life of Gaoyang. In 577, Northern Zhou Yuan Yong defeats the Northern Qi. In Book of Zhou tradition number three, Yuan Yong falls ill on campaign against the Northern Qi, and Yao Songyuan examines and successfully treats him, enabling him to carry out the campaign. And finally, in 581, the Sui is founded by Yang Jian. In Book of Sui tradition number four, Wei Ding reads the physiognomy of a young Yang Jian. Wei Ding tells him he has a ruler's countenance, that of an extraordinary worthy. He also tells Yang Jian that he will rule the nation and live for 60 years. Lai He also read Yang Jian's physiognomy when he was young. Lai He first ordered his attendants to leave the room, then told Yang Jian that his eyes shined like stars and he would someday rule. So, figures commemorated in our traditions can be connected directly or indirectly to most of the major political transitions that took place between the late 4th and late 6th centuries. Many of them are accredited with some of the greatest scientific and literary achievements of their age, and as a whole, they hailed from a variety of places in North China. I have detailed defenses of each of these claims, but to save time, I'd like to move on to what the traditions reveal about fate, freedom, and prognostication. The standard histories generally promote an imperial Han-Confucian view of a morally resonant, holistic, and locative cosmos with a thearch or emperor acting as a central pivot between heaven and humanity and as the sole recipient of heaven's mandate, or Ming. There are quite a few accounts in our biographical traditions that emphasize a direct link between the ruler's personal virtue and the macrocosm, right conduct resulting in cosmic harmony, wrong conduct resulting in disaster. The Book of Zhou tradition of Li Jingxi, for example, not only records a memorial by Li in which he cites the Thearch's lack of frugality as the direct cause of a terrible drought at the time, but he also cites the following classical precedents to defend his harsh criticisms. According to the Spring and Autumn Annals, a ruler's rise must be documented and his actions must conform to the canons and rites. The yin and yang in flood or drought arrive as a response to his actions. Confucius said, "Speaking of actions, all those carried out by the gentleman move heaven and earth, so he must be cautious." The Thearch, however, did not live in a vacuum. There were many other people involved in the operations of the Imperium, all with their own contingent and dynamic mandates, allotments, fates, or lives, all Ming in literary Chinese. Some Ming were bound to individual lives, others to specific regions or slices of time, like days, months, and years. One constant, however, was that the rulers needed good help and good advisors. As the following passage, recorded in one of Li Jingxi's memorials, clearly states. "Your humble minister has also heard that as for the essentials of governance, they rest in selecting and electing. If the handling of this is off by a hair, then it will be off by 1,000 li. And those who take their places later will then be beset with a kindling pile, or a powder keg, of derision. Thus, those who govern by means of the good of the ancients thread their fish together in order to consistently appoint based on abilities. Officially rank people at court and do not employ private affections. Measure their talents to give them official posts and weigh their abilities to assign duties to them. If offices obtain these talents and employment matches their capacities, the 6 reins of governance will be fully under control, and just by sitting, one will advance forward 1,000 li. The need for good help is a major theme throughout our collections, and there are numerous accounts of potential officers of state being tested by Thearchs for their mantic and medical skills, and for their virtue. For example, Northern Wei General Murong Xiaozong tests Xin Dufang's virtue by offering him a mule and maidservants. Xin Dufang refuses to ride the mule and refuses to touch the maidservants, passing the test, so to speak. In another example, Northern Wei Thearch Xianwen tests Xu Jian's skills in pulse diagnosis by placing patients behind a curtain and having him diagnose their conditions based only on pulse. Once again, he passes the test quite successfully. In another example, Northern Qi Thearch Wenxuan tests Huang Puyu's skills in physiognomy by blindfolding him and having him touch the faces of court members to read their personal characters and prognosticate their lots in life. Once again, turns out successfully, and he is hired immediately by the Northern Qi Thearch. In another, General Gao Cheng tests the blind voice physiognomist Master Wu by having family members speak to him. He interprets their personal characters and prognosticates their futures based on their voices. Northern Qi, in the last example I have here, Northern Qi Thearch Wu Cheng tests Wei Ning's skills in predicting fated emoluments and mandated lifespans, but it backfires, as I'll explain in a moment. Deterministic notions of fate or destiny was an ever-present web, I'm sorry, deterministic notions of fate or destiny as an ever-present web or net emerged from and helped create and sustain the locative, holistic, bounded, and patterned views of the cosmos promoted by the politically centralized theocracies of Han and medieval China. They also help promote different means of calculating fate and determining heaven's mandate. However, utopian outs or methods of liberation or escape seem to always accompany locative cosmologies and their deterministic views of fate. Means of escaping from the locative net hide in the background of the imperial Han Confucian worldviews promoted in our traditions, but they are present. Perhaps the best examples resonate with Huang Lao ideals and religious Taoist movements and practices they helped develop. Consider the following examples, one from the Book of Northern Qi's tradition of Wei Ning, and one from the Book of Zhou's tradition of Yao Sun Yuan. Wei Ning was a native of Zhulu. Because he was skilled at predicting fated emoluments and mandated lifespans, he was recruited to be a lodged client. Thearch Wu Cheng personally tested his abilities, and Wei Ning was right every time. Afterwards, Thearch Wu Cheng entrusted a stranger with his own month and year of birth to retest Wei Ning. Wei Ning said, "You have reached the apex of your fortune and fame, and this year you will enter the grave." Thearch Wu Cheng was shocked and later said to Wei Ning, "Those were my month and year of birth." Wei Ning changed his explanation, saying, "Since you're the Thearch, you yourself have methods to escape this." So the Thearch had methods to overcome, circumvent, or escape his fated emolument and mandated lifespan. Here, Wei Ning is likely referring to the kinds of methods introduced in the following passage from the tradition of Yao Sung Yuan. Great General and Duke of Xiangle, He Lanmong, suffered from a qi malady, which additionally caused water swelling, wheezing, and a rapid heartbeat, and discomfort sitting or reclining. Some recommended that he take a great medicinal powder for severing Ming, but his family suspected that he was not yet capable of severing it, so they asked Yao Sengyuan. Yao Sengyuan said, "I'm willing to say that for this affliction, a great powder is not appropriate. If you yourself want to ingest it, I won't bother you by presenting you with questions." As a result, he gave up and left. The duke's son, He Lanyin, earnestly bowed down and pleaded with his father, saying, "For much time, I have repressed my grievances, but today I will give them free rein for the first time. If in the end you are unwilling to be treated, my aims will truly not have been fulfilled." Yao Sengyuan knew that the duke could recover, so he prepared a prescription for him, urging him to take it immediately. The duke's qi gradually became unimpeded, and he then ingested another dose, and all of his maladies were completely cured. So what is this great medicinal powder for severing Ming? It seems to be a drug for extending life and transcending one's mandated lifespan. I think this powder has much in common with the dry herbal cakes, or yao ar, that Xu Jian ingested with Taoist talismans to maintain his vigor in Book of Wei tradition number 10. It's also connected to the dietary regimen that You Daorong adopted to seek the secrets of extending life in Book of Northern Qi tradition number 1. He ended up cutting himself off from grains and drank infusions of pine, atractalis, and tuckahoe. And the great medicinal powder for severing Ming is much like the 9 times refined golden elixir that Zhang Yuanyu prepared for Gaoyang in the Book of Northern Qi. Upon receiving it, Gaoyang purportedly said, "I covet the mundane realm because it allows for the production of medicine. And since it is impossible to immediately fly up to heaven, I'll wait until I'm on the verge of death to consume it." All of these methods are meant to free oneself from deterministic views of fate or Ming, but they leave much behind as well. Note that at least 2 of the accounts I just cited expressed an unwillingness to immediately take the medicine, powder, or elixir. To sever Ming is to escape from fate, but it is also regarded as a renunciation of this world. It is freedom, but a very extreme kind of freedom. In addition to the kind of ontological freedom that one can achieve through elixirs and special dietary regimens, notions of social and technical freedom are also present in our sources. The former involves freedom from society and from social and political entanglements. Perhaps the earliest precedent for this in Confucian teachings comes from Analects 8.13, where the master states, "When the Tao prevails in the world, appear; when it does not, hide." A strong eremitic tradition developed in Confucian culture through the Warring States period, and it continued to grow. It promoted freedom and power through renunciation, isolation, and autonomy, and it is well represented in each of our 4 collections. 7 of the 57 figures commemorated in our first 4 collections secluded themselves in the mountains for significant periods of time, and 6 were itinerant wanderers for significant periods during their lives. Isolation and itinerancy are important sources of social freedom and knowledge acquisition in our traditions, but all but 1 of our examples rejoined human society, and all but 2 were awarded imperial posts. Actually, a vast majority of our doctors, diviners, and craftsmen serve the throne, about 48 out of the 57 examples, and about 1/2 of the individual mantic and medical consultations described in our first 4 collections were performed for the Thearch, and the number jumps to 47 out of 55 when generals, princes, and consorts are counted. Most of our subjects played the game and participated in fate in the calculation of it, which is precisely why they were commemorated or let in. Finally, there's a kind of technical freedom discernible in some of the arts, techniques, formulas, and skills mentioned in our collections. a freedom that results from the mastery and internalization of techniques. I'll skip my defense of this third form of freedom to conclude with a few remarks on prognostication. Prognostication is clearly the most pervasive activity in our collections, particularly with regard to mantic practices, but there are clear connections to medical prognosis, tsila, and to arts as well, especially skills in the interpretation of script. The literary Chinese term for prognostication is zhang, a character that the early 2nd century CE Shuowen Jiezi, or Explanations of Graphs and Compound Characters, glosses as shi zhao wen ye, to inspect the omen of an inquiry. This tradition echoes the division of ritual labor we find in ancient descriptions of Chinese divinatory rites or processes, which involved divinatory encoders or buren, who manufactured omens and tallies, and prognostic decoders or zhanren, who interpreted or tallied them. Zhan, however, increasingly connotes a combination of both divination and prognostication over the course of the medieval period, and the standardization and homologization of interpretive systems used to decode omens increasingly drew attention to the interpretive side of mantic practices. Systems of representation like the five phases were incorporated into traditional mantic and medical practices, which previously had no need for them, and new techniques like prognostic observation or zhan ho featured the immediate interpretation of natural signs rather than long-term observation or the human production of omens. As I argued earlier, medieval doctors and diviners, and craftsmen too, relied on correlative cosmology and accreted grammars of hermeneutic illumination like the sexagenary stems and branches, yin yang, and the five phases. All of these systems of interpretation rest behind the practices listed on the last page of the handout. All were promoted in medieval imperial courts as orthodox systems of viewing the world, and all provided additional parameters for letting the right ones into our 6th and 7th century collections of traditions of doctors, diviners, and artisans in late 4th to early 7th century North China. Thank you.